Well, hi again. This is Bob Brundage, and today is June the 19th, 2004. Today I'm talking with a gentleman up in Lebanon, New Hampshire, named David Millstone. I was intrigued by some of the commentary that I saw from him on the traditional Square Dance Callers email discussion group, and I've been in contact with him by email several times since, and I just felt as though we had to get an interview with him. So, David, why don't you tell me a little bit about where you were born and brought up and a little about life before square dancing.
Okay. I grew up in Pennsylvania. I was born in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, home of the Little League, and lived there until high school, and then my family moved to York, Pennsylvania, in South Central PA. And at that point, had no connection with traditional dance. In high school, I started playing guitar, folk guitar. A friend brought a guitar over, and I stayed with that and still play guitar a little bit. Went to college in Pennsylvania, Haverford College, graduated from Haverford in 1968, and then over the course of the next few years, lived in various parts of the country, Denver and Chicago, lived in San Francisco for a few years. And then in January of 1972, came to New England to visit two friends for what was going to be a two-week trip. And here I am.
Okay.
So 30-some years later. I arrived in New Hampshire in the middle of January 2nd on a raging snowstorm. And something about it felt right.
Uh-huh.
I think it was those years of living in San Francisco where the weather doesn't change much.
Right.
And shortly after I got here, some friends dragged me to a contra dance with Dudley Laufman. And that was my first exposure to this kind of dance. And by the mid-70s, I was hooked. It took a second time. The first dance I went to, I didn't know what was going on. I loved the music. Just loved the music, but didn't know what I was doing, and everyone in the hall looked like they knew what they were doing, and I was very nervous, and so I didn't go again. There wasn't a dance nearby, but then a couple years later, a friend, a housemate, said, "We're going to the dance in South Stratford," and I went along, and that was it, and then from then on, every chance I got, I was off dancing.
Right. Was that Dudley again?
That was Dudley, yep. And so this is the early 70s, and Dudley was like a force of nature.
Yes.
Sort of everywhere you turned, there were Dudley dances. And,
right.
And he was calling once a month in South Stratford, Vermont, which was about 20 miles from where I lived, and that was the dance that we went to every month.
Right.
At that time, he was married to Patty.
Yes.
His second wife, and she was there banging away on her drum and keeping a close eye on her husband.
Right.
And I just fell in love with it.
Right. Well, I knew Dudley back at the University of Massachusetts when I worked there back in the early 1950s.
Oh, my God.
Well, would you call him one of your mentors?
Yeah. I mean, Dudley was... I mean, and there's still a vast amount of my repertoire that I use for family dances, you know, one-night stands, weddings, that comes from Dudley.
Right.
And he certainly had a profound influence on me. Many years later, after I had been calling for quite a while, sort of fast forward, Dudley got to a period in his life where he was tired of calling. I mean, this is a man who, well, still does 300 gigs a year.
Yes.
And he was getting pretty tired, so he'd get some jobs, and he'd call me up and say, "You want to call this one? I'll be your music."
All right.
And I'd say, "Fine," and I'd go along and call, but Dudley, being Dudley, would have a few things to say, and he'd end up calling a couple. and I noticed at that point, since I'd been calling for a while and I could see these things, I noticed how economical he was in his instructions.
Uh-huh.
And this was a time where I might say something like, "Everybody swing your partner." And Dudley would say, all swing.
Right. Yes.
And, I mean, he had been working for years and years and years in schools. I mean, he'd do 180 days a year in schools, and that's how long the school calendar is.
Right.
And a lot of that was working without amplification, and I'm sure he had developed some skills just to protect his voice.
Right.
And so in terms of learning to teach a dance quickly, in terms of having a repertoire of real simple dances that you can use with anybody, that you don't have to spend a lot of time teaching.
Right.
Because teaching is anathema to Dudley. He just wants to play the music and get you moving.
Right.
I learned a lot from him.
Well, this is a feature of Don Armstrong, too. He was very, very precise. I am sure he studied the way you describe something.
Yes.
Especially the more complicated contras.
Yes.
And he was really a past master at that.
Yes.
Did you ever know Don?
I did. I met Don on two occasions when he was on staff at the Ralph Page Dance Legacy Week.
Yes.
In fact, one of them shortly before he died.
Right.
And so I got to dance to him and talk with him some.
Yes.
And obviously, in retrospect, wish that I had had more time. But,
sure.
But just was... When I got from the Lloyd Shaw Foundation a copy of the movie that was made, The Visible Anthem.
Yes.
Which I was watching that movie, and there's a guy in a classroom sort of teaching how to call. And I looked, and I called for my wife. I said, Sheila, look, it's a young Don Armstrong.
Right.
And there are a couple moments in that movie where someone is calling for a dance, and it's clearly Don. I mean,
yes.
His inflection, his articulation.
Right.
The man was so precise.
Right.
With his use of language.
So yes.
It was always very easy to understand him.
Right.
And one of the things that I liked about Don is that he really felt strongly, as I do, about the importance of variety.
Right.
In a dance program.
Yes.
Which is a battle that in the contra dance world some of us are fighting.
Right, right. How about your association with Ralph Page?
I did not have much to do with Ralph. I started calling, and Ralph was down in Keene, and I was caught up in the Dudley scene, the sort of younger callers.
Yes.
And so only overlapped with Ralph at the very end.
Right.
The person who had the greatest impact on me as a caller was Ted Cinella.
Oh, is that so? Okay.
I had been calling for... Oh, a few years. I don't remember how many exactly. And before I met Ted, and we invited him over to this area to call the dance. And he ran a caller's workshop.
Right.
And there were three of us at the caller's workshop. And he went through an hour and a half's worth of material with us. And it was like Saul on the road to Damascus.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God. So this is what you need to think about.
Yes.
Because up until that point, my models, I mean, there was Dudley, who just sort of spouted stuff off the top of his head.
Yes.
And then I was dancing with Jack Perrin and Chris Madigan and a few other New England callers. And the model would typically be, they'd call a dance, the dance would end, and then there'd be 3, 4, 5, 6 minutes while they were sort of shuffling through cards and thinking about what to do next and... maybe this, maybe that, and everyone socializing. Ted walked in for that evening's dance, and he had his program planned.
Yes.
He had his alternates planned.
Right.
He had the tunes in mind for each of the dances.
Yes.
And I came to find out that if he was working with a band that he didn't know, he'd get in touch with them ahead of time to find out their repertoire, to get recordings of theirs.
Right.
He'd spend as much time... or more time planning for the dance
yes.
than the dance itself took.
Right.
And that was a whole new concept.
Yeah. Yeah, he was very well organized. I knew him way, way, way back. I don't know if you knew that I was on the board of directors of New England Folk Festival.
In the 50s, you
said. The 50s, yes.
Yes.
And that's where I met Ted and Connie Taylor and...
Uh-huh.
And, well, people that I've even forgotten since then. But,
right.
Well, that's very interesting. I noticed that you mentioned more than once that you were interested in square dancing in movies.
Yes.
And did you know that Alan Brozek has a lot of movie clips?
No.
Did you know? Do you know Alan?
I've been in touch with him. He's in Connecticut.
Yes.
He sent me an audio tape.
Oh, yes.
Of your brother.
Right.
And Ed Gilmore.
Oh, yes.
Calling at a New Year's Eve dance in Connecticut from the 50s.
All right.
And no, I didn't know. I knew that Larry Edelman collects movie clips.
Yes.
And I've never met Larry, but we've corresponded. He's out
yes.
in Colorado. But I didn't know that Al has one. So
yes.
I will definitely speak to him about that.
Yeah, he played it for me the day I interviewed him at his home.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, we were old friends because of the Connecticut Callers Association and so forth, dating way, way back to the early days of the Callers Association and the early days of Modern Western.
Right.
So, but he's another one that is, he's stuck to the Contra. He, you know, all his club dances, I think he calls a Contra or two.
Uh-huh.
And very interesting guy. But, yeah, I wanted to bring that up. But speaking of videos, I'd like to hear more about this unique name called Paid to Eat Ice Cream.
Okay. Well, for years, I mean, as I mentioned, Ted was sort of my calling guru.
Right.
And for years, I felt that someone should make a movie about him, just that he was such an important figure in the Contra dance world.
Right.
And then he up and died.
Yes.
And at too young an age,
Cheryl
and I went over to visit him about 2 weeks before he actually died in Maine, and got him on what Jean, his wife, said was probably his last good day. So Ted was gone, and there was no movie.
Right.
And I started thinking about, well, maybe someone could do one posthumously, but realized, you know, so much of the fun of a movie is seeing the person. The
sure.
real, and I didn't know what there was for footage. So I sort of thought about the dance world and thought, well, who's left? And one of the people who came to mind was Dudley. Another was Bob McQuillan.
Right.
And in 98, I had a sabbatical leave. I've been an elementary school teacher. I just retired a year ago.
Right.
And I had a leave, and I submitted as part of my proposal that I was going to spend part of that year learning more about video production.
Uh-huh.
I just thought that that was a really interesting skill to develop. And so in the course of that year, I started learning about video. And, no, it was the following year, 99. Because in summer of 99, I was on staff at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. I was one of the callers representing New Hampshire. The festival always sort of spotlights three groups. So that year it was South Africa, Romania, and New Hampshire.
Right.
And they had, we had sent a huge contingent, about 140 people from the state of New Hampshire, stonemasons, carpenters, timber framers, sugar makers, and a bunch of musicians and dance callers, a couple callers. And during the course of the time I was there, I arranged with the videographer from Smithsonian Folklife to tape an interview that I did with Bob.
Okay.
We shot about an hour's footage. And I had that as the first interview for what was going to be this project about learning about videos. So I decided, as I mentioned to you earlier, that I'd just sit down with Bob and start shooting interviews with him on tape.
Right.
And we did another interview at his house. And then I said, Bob, you know, we need to visit some of these places you're talking about. So I went down another day and got in Bob's Jeep, and off we headed from one place to another, careening around corners. Bob was not what I would call a slow driver.
Like he plays the piano.
Yeah, he keeps a good clip. We got in, I said, aren't you going to put your seatbelt on? He said, last I heard, they're not required in the state of New Hampshire. And I had my camera on a tripod sitting in front of me and just sort of pointed it at him and had everything on auto focus and auto levels and filmed a bunch of interviews with Bob driving around telling stories. Oh, you know, there's the house that we bought.
Yeah.
And a story about how it had been a house of ill repute and the guy who ran it was just about run out of town and came to Bob and offered it to him at a good price. It's just story after story.
Sure.
And Bob was not eager to have this project happen. I asked him several times, and he kept saying, no, you don't want to do that. And then finally he said, this is something you really want to do, isn't it? And I said, yeah. And he said, all right. And from then on, any time I called him up and said, can we get together, we'd work out a date, he was available, he never once asked to see the footage as it was going along, never asked how the project was going.
Uh-huh.
And by the fourth interview, I had given him some hints. I said, Bob, you know, I don't want to just make a Walt Disney version of your life. I'd worked with Bob over the years and knew there had been some pretty difficult moments along the way.
Right.
And during that last interview, he was willing to talk about some fairly difficult things. He talked about his drinking, and what finally led to his stopping cold. He almost killed somebody.
Uh-huh.
And he talked about that. And he talked about Pete and April, Pete Colby and April Limber, his two good friends who died on the same day. Pete died in the hospital, and April took her own life. And that was a pretty shattering event for the guy.
Sure.
And he was willing to talk about that. And so I had all kinds of footage, and the more I talked to Bob, the more I realized, whoa, well, let's get some of the rest of the story. So I interviewed Dudley, and then I interviewed people who had worked with Bob over the years, Deanna Stiles, who was with him in the Canterbury and with him now in Old New England, and a bunch of other people, and then realized that Bob had been involved, and he started playing with Ralph Page in 1947.
Right.
And is still playing. So I realized that through Bob's life, I could look at contra dancing for the last basically 50 years
right.
in New England. And he worked with the who's who. So looking at Bob, let me look at Ralph Page.
Right.
So we have a little chapter, as it were, in the movie about Ralph Page. And then he worked for 26 consecutive years with Duke Miller.
Yes.
So I was able to have a section about Duke Miller. And many dancers today, of course, didn't know a thing about Duke Miller. Although I think his Fitzwilliam dance was a very important dance.
Oh, yes.
In sort of contra dance history. A lot of people came through that dance and got
right.
very excited
right.
as a result of that.
Yeah, did you know he dabbled in modern Western?
I did.
Yeah.
He had been a modern Western caller, I think.
Yeah.
And then met up with Ralph.
Yeah.
And took Ralph's Monadnock Folkways
right.
class with Ralph and Gene Gowing.
Yeah.
And I think that's what got him going as a contra dance caller
right.
as well.
And what a beautiful dancer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, everyone I've talked to talks about that.
But yeah.
He and his wife Jean would get up and demonstrate, and
right.
people would just sit in awe.
Yes. Big man, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I knew Duke for many, many years.
Uh-huh.
And Jean.
Yep.
Well, yeah, he was one I was going to ask you about.
Well, I went to some of those Fitzwilliam dances.
Did
but
you?
Again, at that time, I mean, in the same way that you ask people who are just starting to dance now, you know, you say, well, where'd you go? Oh, we went to Montpelier. Well, who was the caller? Oh, I don't know. Well, who was the band? Oh, gee, there's a fiddler, I guess. But, you know, when you're so caught up in the dancing in the early stages, you don't pay attention to much of that stuff.
That's true.
You know, you're just there to dance and dance.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
have a great time. And, you know, many of the people on the floor aren't really paying much attention to the music. As long as there's a beat.
Right.
If they can dance it. Well, in modern Western squares, you certainly know about that.
Yes.
So I was able to do a section about Duke Miller, and then Bob played with Dudley, so I was able to have a whole section about Dudley and the Canterbury Orchestra. I had a chunk about Pete and April and New England tradition, and then Bob's current band, Old New England.
Okay, well.
And then also had a piece about Bob's tune writing, because and at the time he had written over 1,000 tunes.
He's Is that right? Over, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's now over 1,100 tunes that he's published.
Huh. Well.
And also a chunk about his style of playing piano.
Yes.
Very clear.
Right.
Because I'm a boom chucker.
Right. Yeah.
I don't do any of that fancy stuff. And
yeah.
He says, you know, it would be nice sometimes. You know, he has a lot of respect, and he names some people that he cared about.
Yeah.
But, we got him on piano, on camera, talking about that. And since my project was to learn about video production, I decided, well, instead of just having all this footage, I'd learn how to edit it, and then proceeded to edit it on my computer and made a movie of it.
Right.
And then we showed that movie for the first time at the Ralph Page Weekend.
Oh, yes.
As part of that weekend, there's always a workshop called the Retrospective.
Yes.
It's a sort of a look back at dance history. And for many years, it focused on Ralph and his programs. One year, right after Ted died, there was sort of a look at Ted.
Yes.
Where George Fogg was the MC and presented an evening at Porter Square.
Right.
Sort of a typical program of Ted's,
yes.
Ted's material.
Uh-huh.
And the year that we did Bob, we made him the subject of the retrospective.
Yes.
Which was the first time it had been focused on a musician, and it was the first time that it was focused on someone who was alive.
Yes.
And so that was the world premiere of Paid to Eat Ice Cream.
Right.
You know, do you understand the title?
No, not really.
Well, that's one of Bob's lines. When people say, you know, well, how do you feel about, you know, playing for dance piano? And he says, someone comes up to you and hands you a bowl of chocolate ice cream and says, I'll pay you $10 to eat this bowl of ice cream. He said, that's how I feel about playing for dances. Because I'm doing what I really like to do, and someone's paying me money as well.
Right, right. That's
so we showed the movie in the theater at UNH. They have a wonderful movie theater, seats about 200 people, and we had standing room only. We had every seat filled, 250 people in there. One of Bob's daughter came up from Florida. A son of his came in from far away, and a third son showed up. Bob didn't know they were going to be there.
Uh-huh.
So there were people there from all parts of his life. We showed the movie, and the last part of the movie, the closing credits, are done over a bunch of... it's a waltz playing, and the waltz, of course, is Amelia, which is Bob's most famous waltz, his best-known waltz. And you see people on the dance floor at Peterborough Dance with people waltzing. And the music is a montage of many different people playing that tune. So the first four bars might be someone playing it, and then it'll switch and it'll be someone else, all synchronized together.
Right.
So this is being projected on the screen, and people have been laughing because there are parts of the movie that are hilarious, and people have been crying. The hankies are out because there are some parts that are pretty sad. And the closing credits go, and Bob's sitting in the front row, and he turns around and holds out his hand, and a woman, young woman sitting behind him, gets up, and the two of them start waltzing on the floor in the very front of the theater with the credits going on the screen behind them. And half the audience is sitting there saying, who's that? And the other half reaches for their hankies.
Right.
Because it's Bob dancing with Amelia,
uh-huh.
Who was 3 or 4 when he wrote the tune for her, and she's now in her 20s.
I'll be darned.
And it was quite a moment.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So.
Well, okay, getting back to dancing in movies and to... these various interviews, are you familiar with the term, Jim Mayo?
Yeah, he's also recently published a book.
Yes, right.
And he's somewhere, we've talked a little, he's somewhere on the seacoast of New Hampshire, I think?
No, he's inland.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Fairly close to the Massachusetts border.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll send you his address.
Okay.
And so forth. But he intended to do an interview project like this one that I'm doing, but he was going to try to do it with video.
Uh-huh.
But to do that, you mean now you've got to have a couple of cameras, you got to have a couple of cameramen.
Uh-huh.
And it got to be too complicated, and he never got to finish it. But
interesting. Did he start on it?
I don't really know if he ever did.
Because I'd love to talk to him. Because that's part of what I'm doing now.
Yes.
I went down and talked with Ralph Sweet.
Yeah, I know you did.
And shot 3 hours of an interview with him.
Right.
And again, it started out the same way as with Bob. Let's get some videotape.
Yes.
But I've also now got some footage of Ralph calling dances, and so it might be possible in time to put together something like that.
Some kind of a montage, yeah.
Exactly.
Right. Well.
But you're right. It is. It's one more technical difficulty to get in the way.
Right.
And
right.
You know, ever since I made the McQuillan movie and realized how little of our history has been recorded, because I was looking for old movies of Ralph Page calling, and actually found some footage that no one knew existed, some black and white footage that Michael Herman had shot.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Huh.
I was going all over looking for old dance footage, and I could find footage from the South.
Yes.
Movies that were made during the Depression, probably the WPA.
Right.
In Arkansas, and flat foot dancing, and some squares, and even some newsreel footage, the overall tone of which was, well, howdy ma, howdy pa, saddle up the mule, and let's go see what the folks are doing on the old farmstead.
Very sort
of condescending.
Yeah.
But couldn't find any New England dance footage.
Yes.
And then finally was at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts, which boasts that it has the world's largest collection of film and video and still photographs of dance, at something like 10 or 15,000 items. And I had been through their catalog and couldn't find much. Found some Super 8 movies of square dancing on horseback.
Uh-huh.
just some oddball things, but nothing that would really work for my project.
Yes.
And started asking the librarian, well, you know, can you think of anything else? And she thought for a bit and said, well, you know, there's this library at University of New Hampshire. Nope, been there and done that.
Right.
You know, there's a New England Historic Archive up in Maine. Nope, talk to them. They don't have anything. Smithsonian, no. Library of Congress, no. And there was this long pause, and she said, well, there's... No, but you couldn't look at that yet. And, of course, my antenna started flickering.
Sure.
And I said, what's that? She said, well, we do have a box of movies that were given to the library, but they haven't been cataloged yet.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, what can you tell me about them? Well, it turns out that after Michael and Marianne Herman had died, this box of film was given to the library, and in fact it had not been cataloged, had not been processed, and after going through a couple hoops, they agreed that I could look at the footage there.
I'll be there.
And they set me up with the techie up in one of the labs.
Yeah.
He had one of these hand crank spools, and it turned out to be 16 millimeter. We thought it was going to be 8 millimeter, but
right. Nice.
It was real 16 millimeter footage. And so I'm taking footage in some cases that's still sitting in the boxes with mold all over the cardboard or the cans.
Yes.
Taking the footage out and cranking through. There was something like 70 reels of tape, of film. And I'm hand cranking. And after a while, the guy, the techie there, realized that I knew what I was doing and sort of let me alone. And at the end of the first day, I'd been through about 40 or 45 and had found nothing that was useful for me. Lots of great dance footage for people interested in folk dance, international folk dance.
Yes.
And so while I was looking at it, I'd catalog it roughly, saying, you know, looks like You know, it might be Irish set dancing because they were in squares and doing real fast footwork and round the house. I haven't done much international folk. So sometimes I'd say, you know, this tape is a man teaching other men only, just men's dances or just women's dances. So at the least, I was doing a little bit of a favor for the library. Or this role is incredibly overexposed.
Right.
I'm staying with friends in New York, and they said, did you find anything? I said, no. They said, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'll go back tomorrow. You know, I'll finish up the batch.
Yeah.
And I got to about roll 62 or something like that. And not only is there nothing on it that I want, it's upside down and backwards.
Oh, dear. Because
it hasn't been rewound properly. And I'm sort of craning my neck, and it's like home movies of Easter or Thanksgiving, people sitting around a big table. And I was just about to say, to hell with this one, and wind it back. And I said, no, you said you were going to look at them all. And I cranked a couple more cranks and let out a shriek, because there's Ralph Page, upside down and backwards, standing at the microphone.
I'll be darned. David, I'm going to have to stop and turn the tape over. Hold on. Okay, you just let out a shriek.
I let out a shriek, and the guy, the techie who was working over in the far corner of that room, said, I think you found something. And sure enough, on that reel and the next one, there were shots of Ralph standing out. Of course, this is all silent. Ralph calling, shots of his band at the time, and it must have been a time when he took some musicians, because you can see Dick Richardson and others in his orchestra. I'm guessing he took them down to New York to Michael Herman's dance studio and called for a dance there. So I ended up using some of that footage in Pateed Ice Cream, and was very happy to find it. The library waived their customary charges for using footage, which is extraordinarily expensive, but the film had shrunk, so we had to have a new negative made, and blah, blah, blah. It ended up costing $500 or $600 to end up getting that footage, but it was nice to have.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, course of doing that, I realized how few images there were of dancing from the past.
Right.
And resolved that, well, if we can't dig up anything more from the past, we can at least do a better job of leaving a record for the people who are still to come.
Right.
So I wrote an article for the CDSS News, encouraging people to start taking footage, to set up a camera, to take pictures, to do what you're doing, to interview people. And from time to time, I'll go to a dance and set up a camera and just let it run.
Yes. Let's see, it reminds me the last dance that I called in Connecticut before I moved to Albuquerque was a video taped by Paul... Paul Trowbridge.
Oh.
And he's got titles on it and everything. Maybe
T-R-O-W?
I should...
T-R-O-W?
T-R-O-W-B-R-I-D-G-E, yeah.
And where is he?
He lives in Connecticut.
Do you know where?
Around the University of Connecticut area, Willimantic.
Okay.
I believe, yeah. And I don't think he's actively calling, but... Unfortunately, he just came in and he set up a camera on a tripod, so a lot of the footage shows the same people doing the same thing, you know.
Yep.
But it was too bad he didn't take the camera, but he was busy dancing.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure. Well, that's one of the things I've learned, is that when you just set the camera up, of course, you get a picture, and anything is better than nothing.
Yeah.
But if you've got someone behind the camera who's periodically swinging it over so you can see the caller, or if there's live musicians.
Well, this dance was with live music. It was a modern Western club dance.
Uh-huh. What year was this, Bob?
Just before I moved here, about 99, something like that.
Uh-huh.
No, it was earlier than that. What am I talking about? I've been here 10 years.
Okay.
Well, anyway... maybe I should send it to you so you can look at it.
That would be fun to see.
Yeah.
Fun to see. Can you make a copy of it?
No, I don't have a copy of it. But
It's videotape or film?
No, it's It's videotape.
Yeah. I'd love to see it, and I could copy what I might use and then return it to you.
Sure, okay.
That's easy to do. I've got the capabilities of doing it.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, I shared the program with Culver Griffin. I don't know if you know him. He's an old-time caller, still using 78 RPM records.
No way.
And I interviewed him all, as well.
Huh.
But
where is he?
He lives up in up above Brookfield, Connecticut. In fact, in Bridgewater, Connecticut.
Uh-huh.
And so he did all the old thing. He did Dip and Dive, and he did Slaunch to Donegal. And in the meantime, I'm doing regular club dancing with this live band, the Pioneer Trio, that I worked with for 60 years. That was three fellas played together for 60 years.
Oh, my God.
The fiddler just passed away a few months ago.
The Pioneer Trio?
Yeah. Trio. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, I thought you'd probably like to see that.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, I'll send it to you.
Okay. And Culver Griffin is still alive? And
yes, yeah.
Wow.
One of the things he said when I went to Chip Hendrickson's 60th birthday party, he was there, and he said he was the only man on Social Security that had a daughter in kindergarten that belonged to him. Which was true. But anyway. Well, it's interesting that some of that stuff from the Michael and Marianne Herman wound up somewhere else. I thought everything went to Stu Shacklett out in...
No, I think I think Stu Shacklett got all the folk dancer records.
Right, yeah.
And I don't know what else they had. I just heard that they got like two tractor trailer loads.
Yes, he did, yeah.
Right, and so
crossed them a bunch.
These ended up at the New York Public Library.
I see. Yeah, well, of course, he archived all that stuff, and he had the rights, and he's copied some of that, put it out on CD.
Yep, they have.
And I was there before he'd finished cataloging everything at they built a special hall.
Right.
Building. And
just to hold it all.
Yes. And when I was there, I've got pictures showing boxes and boxes and boxes just sitting there. And, it took two full trailer loads and,
right.
and an awful lot of work and $25,000 to move it.
Wow.
But,
I know it's coming out on CD. My one wish is that, and I don't know whether he's got that capability, is that when you take some of the old recordings, You can clean them up quite a bit.
Yes.
Electronically.
Yeah. Right.
I had the sense that they weren't doing much of that. That they were basically sort of re-recording it and out it was going. And I've heard some old 78s that were put onto tape, and then someone went through and spent quite a bit of time cleaning them up.
Yeah.
And the difference is extraordinary.
Yes.
I mean, you can really hear the caller much more clearly. There's some separation. The caller's voice stands out in front, and
I think that's
a time-consuming process.
Yeah. Well, I thought he'd cleaned them up. I know Bill Litchman, with the things that he's done for Lloyd Shaw, the CDs he's put out for them have been cleaned up, and they're really, really good.
Uh-huh.
Because he has the rights for Western Jubilee, Windsor, and two or three other smaller labels.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But, this has all been very, very interesting. Just checking over some of my notes. Yeah, you'll have to get a hold of Jim Mayo. Have you talked to Stu Shacklett?
I tried at one point. I found I sent him an email a long time ago about something, and ended up not getting a reply from him, but from David, is that his name?
Yes.
One of his partners.
Right.
And just the someone else told me that they had sent something to Stu and that he was very, very slow to reply.
Yes, he is.
So I decided that if I need him for something, I'll just give him a call.
Yeah.
And no, I haven't. I haven't talked
to him. Now, David is his financial backer, a retired doctor.
Uh-huh.
And he's the one that built the building and so forth and paid for the records to be moved. And the Kentucky Dance Foundation, right?
Right.
So,
Now one of the things I'm trying to learn more about is this Kentucky Dance Institute that was held at Moorhead.
Right.
Do you know anything about that?
Not really, no.
Just in the course of the research that I'm doing now, I mean, it's this whole research thing is a relatively new project for me, and it certainly adds another dimension to the calling. It's fun. Part of what I find when I call is that I try to throw in, I'm working with the Country Dance and Song Society crowd, not
sure.
the modern Western crowd at all. I mean, that's just a whole other world that I don't know.
Right.
But I find a lot of people who are in it just for the moment. And I'm trying to find ways to help people realize that they are part of a long tradition and that we can enjoy the music and the dance because of other people who have come before us who have kept it alive.
Right.
And one of the best ways I find of sort of getting that point across is telling stories, telling anecdotes.
Yes.
It's one of the reasons I love working with McQuillan, because in the middle of any particular evening, Bob will interrupt the proceedings with a story.
Yes.
And it's a story about, I was dancing in this hall and we did this very dance, blah, 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 blah. And you hope that the dancers who are out there will sort of get a message that this is something that you need to
listen.
Keep alive. And
right.
one of the ways you keep it alive is by bringing new people in.
Yes.
And so one of the things that I'm really enjoying is collecting all these stories from all over the country.
Right.
So that I can try to pass that message on to people.
Right. Well, David, tell me a little bit more about your dance in Norwich, Vermont. It's been going on for 24 years.
Yeah. I started calling with this band, Northern Spy, in 1980. And I didn't call at their very first dance, but we can't figure out whether it was the second or the third dance. So this was a monthly dance. Spy was a new band. They had been practicing for about a year or two, just getting together to play music. I had been calling off and on since the mid to late 70s. I was in a folk band called Sugar Maple, and we just played, a little old-timey music, a little bluegrass, a little Bob Dylan covers, some ballads, you name it. And we'd get asked to do dances, or we'd get asked to do private parties, like a New Year's party or something.
Yes.
Or play at a wedding reception. And then people started saying, well, could you play for some dances? And I'd been dancing, and I went to a friend who was a caller and said, well, can you give me a couple dances? And that's how I got started calling. And And then Northern Spy wanted another caller. They had one guy in the band who was playing banjo and calling, and they asked if I'd join the band. I was playing hammered dulcimer and doing some calling and playing guitar and bass and things like that.
Yeah.
And so we worked it out that for a while we'd split an evening where this other guy, Jeff Lambden, would call part of the evening and I'd play dulcimer and I'd call part of the evening and he'd play banjo.
Right.
And in the early years, we used to joke that, well, if we didn't get many people coming, we'd have enough people in the band to have our own dance, because Spy was 10, 12, 14. I think the most we ever had was 15 people in the band.
Uh-huh.
The guy who started it, a man named Bill Shepard, had been part of Roaring Jelly, which is this huge community band in the Boston area. And all of us, of course, at the time, were greatly influenced by the Canterbury Orchestra, which was
Dudley's.
Yeah, Dudley's group. There could be 20 people on stage.
Right.
I mean, Dudley would maybe hire two people, but everyone else who was welcome to just show up.
Yeah.
So in the early years, Spy was this enormous band, and we ran a monthly dance in Trumbull Hall, which was the social hall of the Baptist Church in Etna, New Hampshire. And after quite a few years, two things happened simultaneously. One was we were outgrowing the hall. It was a beautiful little hall when you had 60 people dancing, and you could dance 80 people in there, but we were getting 100 or 110.
Yeah.
It was just too crowded. And at the same time, the church decided that they wanted to use the hall more, including on Saturday nights, and so it was a parting of the ways. And we bounced around for a year and then settled into Tracy Hall in Norwich, Vermont, which had just had a huge renovation done to it, including putting some soundproofing into the hall.
Uh-huh.
Now, I had danced in that hall in the 70s with Michael McKernan calling with the band Applejack. They came up from the Putney-Brattleboro area. And at that time, the hall was just horrible acoustics, all brick. So the sound would just bounce around like crazy in there. But by the time we got into it with Northern Spy, they'd put some baffles in the back and had lowered the ceiling and put some acoustic tile in and some curtains. So it was a much better hall. And that's where we still, that's where we dance. So we don't dance in July and August. We found that up here people just need that time to,
yeah,
they're working in their gardens until 8:30 at night, and then
right,
wants to shower and go off dancing. So we take a vacation. But the band now is eight musicians plus myself. And we get, on a typical night, anywhere from 125 to 175,
right,
people in the hall. We do free admission for under age 16 and over age 60.
Right.
Because we really want to do everything we can to keep that age span.
Right.
So many dances now, at least in the contra world, it's the same group of people who started out when they were in their late teens or 20s, only now they're in their 40s to 50s.
Right.
And I know that that's a lot of what happened in modern Western.
Right.
Is it seemed that you got a bunch of people who got excited about it and moved just decade after decade, but were not as successful at bringing younger people in.
Right.
I don't know if that's your sense, but that's
yes,
what I've picked up.
Yep.
So we figured if we could get young kids there, just hearing the music, that would be great. And sure enough, families, parents who liked to dance would start bringing their kids because it was cheaper than paying for a babysitter.
Right.
And sure enough, the kids would start dancing. I taught elementary school right across the street from the hall in Norwich.
Uh-huh.
So kids who knew me as an elementary school teacher would sometimes come and bring their parents.
Right.
And over the years, what's happened is we've developed a group of high school kids who have decided that this is the cool thing to do.
Ah, good.
Right, you know, go to a dance with the DJ in the gym at your school with a spinning ball at the top. Nah, that's dull. But go to this. So there are probably three or four high schools in the area now with a bunch of kids who have come to the dances and have decided, hey, this is where it's at.
Well, that's great.
Which is great because you get high school kids into the dance, and of course, a friend of mine said, well, it's like dancing with a grasshopper.
Right.
They're just bouncing around.
Yeah.
They come in, and initially they're all yee-haw and clapping and stomping, and then they look around and notice that, gee, there's no one else in the hall going yee-haw.
Yeah.
And there's no one else in the hall clapping to the music. They're just dancing.
Yeah.
And so over time, they start to bring their friends, and it's one of those spirals. If they walk into the hall and look around and see nothing but the gray and the bald, they're going to say, this isn't for us.
Yeah.
But if they walk in and see a couple of hot young ladies, sort of their age, they'll say, all right, this is the place to be.
Right, right.
And so we end up with this real nice mix. And, of course, having the older people there, the over 60 crowd, I'm almost in that category myself. So I joke with the band, we need to start making it 65 and over. means that we get a nice mix, and I love my home dance because it's our band and me every month.
Yes.
So we're not beholden to another committee.
Right.
I mean, we can sort of do the kind of dance that we want to do.
Yes.
I like to start out the evening with some simple dances. I think that's the best way to program. Since we're not taking people through classes, the idea is anybody who walks in should be able to do it. So
right.
The first couple of dances, I want to teach contra dance progression. I want to teach do-si-do. I want to teach a lady's chain, a right and left through. So I sort of build up figures like that for the first three or four dances so that the newcomers are learning the vocabulary, not by me running a class, but
right.
by me just sort of teaching it with all the other dancers helping out.
Right.
Well, I had some hot shot dancers who came to me, a couple of them, some years ago, and they were upset because I was catering to the beginners.
Right.
And they wanted hay for four in the first dance and
yeah.
all these complicated figures. And I said, I'm not going to do that. I said, that's not my idea of what this dance is about.
Right.
They also didn't like that I'd call squares.
Uh-huh.
They said, no, we just want to dance contra dances. And I said, well, that's fine. You know, there are a lot of dances you can go to and just do contras.
Right.
And they finally announced that they weren't going to come to the dance anymore. And I said, basically,
yeah.
so long, it's been good to know you.
Right.
And so what I love about that dance is that I can call the kind of program that I really think is fun.
Right.
Fred Brunig once told me, he said, I like to program a dance evening that I would like to dance as a dancer.
Right.
And as a dancer, I like that kind of variety. I
yes.
like contras. I like squares. I like having a Sicilian circle or a big circle. I like having a mixer in there. I usually do a mixer third dance of the evening.
Uh-huh.
I like throwing in a triplet or a set of triplets. Just, and then I love these oddball dances. Like, I did 9-pin last month.
Oh, yes.
And people just had a hoot with it.
Sure.
They were laughing and just you could feel the floor relax.
Right.
And I don't know in the modern Western square dance world, but my guess is it's true when you get people who are up into plus or challenge level or something, people who just want more and more and more complex dances.
Yes.
Well, there's that same tendency in the contra dance world. People who
yep.
want... You know, they want the latest hay for four on the left diagonal, and then
right.
you turn your shadow three-quarters of the way around, and you go to your second person this, and it's just, it gets more... And I like dances like that myself from time to time, but
yeah.
I just think a whole evening of that is boring.
Right.
The whole swing your partner, swing your neighbor, swing, swing, swing. You know, a dance like that, I think, is much better when you've done it right after something like British Sorrow.
Uh-huh.
Very elegant, stately, done to a march. And then the band cranks up into something, you know, just a real high-powered reel, and then you go flying around. So I'm able to call that kind of program, and people who come to the dance seem to like it. The people who only dance there think that's normal.
Right.
And then they go off to another contra dance and discover... Oh, everything was duple improper or Beckett formation all night.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you'd mentioned British Sorrow. Way back years ago at one of the national conventions in Denver, Dorothy Shaw was put on a pageant of the history of dancing and asked me to do the contra portion.
Uh-huh.
And one of the dances we did was British Sorrow.
Well, of course.
And... We also did the one that I had just recently recorded called Fairfield Fancy.
Uh-huh.
I recorded on Folkcraft, but I still have a copy of that program.
Huh.
Interesting. Yeah.
There's a lot of Dorothy Shaw in that movie, that Visible Anthem that I made.
Yes.
Yeah. And she's someone, of course, that I haven't run into.
Yes.
So
well,
sometime I'd like to get to a Lloyd Shaw event just to see what it looks like from their perspective.
Right.
So when I get hired to do dances away, the first thing is, if it's a series that I don't know, is to get a sense of what they're looking for. And many places, of course, just want contra, contra, contra.
Yeah.
And I can do that. And if there's other reasons to do the dance, then I will. If it's a chance to work for... with musicians I like, for instance.
Right.
Some years ago, I developed a set of rules for myself for calling.
Yes.
I found myself in a bunch of situations where I just wasn't having fun.
Uh-huh.
And I tried to think of why is that. And so I've come up with rules, and I've found that when I follow the rules, it always ends up being good. And the rules are, I will call for love, or for money. It's those jobs in between that are the killers. So if McQuillan calls me up and he's got a gig, then sure, I'll do it because I know I'm going to have a good time. I'll be playing with Bob, and I don't even ask if I'm going to get paid.
Right.
Go off and do it. Or someone is running a benefit for some event that, you know, cause that I think is a good one. Or the local PTO. I've been doing a dance for 21, 22 years in the city where I live in Lebanon. Every spring we do a family dance. I don't get paid for it. I just do it because it's a lot of fun.
Sure.
Or, you know, someone wants me to call a dance in a city that I'd really love to visit because I've got friends there. Great.
Yeah.
So I've got a reason to do it.
Right.
On the other hand, someone calls up and they got my name from someone who got my name from someone. They're having a wedding. It's 250 guests. It's being catered by the snobby caterer at the fancy establishment. They're spending a gazillion dollars on this. And they're not people I have any vested interest in, then I'll say, sure, I'll do it, and I'll charge them a good fee.
Yep.
Pay the musicians really well, because they're the ones who show up and do these family dances for little or nothing.
Right.
And figure, at the worst, and this rarely happens, at the worst, I'll get there, there'll be a bunch of people who have drunk too much, I'm going to have to plead with the crowd all night to get them on the dance floor.
Yep.
And I'll go home with a good check and put it in our travel fund. All the money I make from dancing, I set aside, and my wife and I use that for travel.
Good.
So that when we go for a trip, it doesn't cost us anything.
Great.
it's sort of time away from my family, and the money goes to time with my family.
Right.
So that's worked out. It's those jobs where you drive 2.5 hours to get there, spend another hour setting up your PA, call for an evening, and people have a good time, but they would have had a good time no matter who was calling that night, because it's a regular weekly dance, and then drive home and get home at 2 in the morning, and you've been paid $45 or $60 for your trouble.
Yeah.
Those in-between jobs, I've just decided I don't need them.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So.
Yeah, good philosophy.
Well, it's worked for me.
Right.
Now, at different points,
I wanted to make mention of one article of yours that I read on the discussion group email list. It was an answer to a question from Seth Tepler.
Uh-huh.
And it was 2 pages long, single-spaced, and really a wonderful treatise on community/family dancing.
Yes.
And it's very interesting. A copy of that will go to the Foundation up in New England.
Uh-huh.
And, well, I think we've covered pretty much everything I wanted to cover.
Well, thank you.
And I know you've got to get ready for a dance this afternoon.
Well, and you've got some heavy transcribing to do.
Yes, right.
I would love it. Do you have the ability to do tape-to-tape copying?
Yes.
I would love it if you could make a copy of this just for me to hang on to myself. I'd love to have a copy of it.
Okay. Now, I'm going to also send you a copy of the people that I've interviewed.
Yes.
Many of them, as I say, some are, I can send you a tape copy. Some I can send you a printed copy.
Okay.
And some I don't have.
Can you mark on that which are the ones that are at least at the moment inaccessible to you?
Yeah.
Because what I'm wondering, let me just run this by you. Would it be politically awkward for me to mention, you know, let's say you've done an interview with someone that I'm really interested in, and it's one that you don't have a transcription of, and it's one that's sitting in Albuquerque 4 blocks from you, but you can't really get to it. Would it be awkward if I wrote Bill Lichman and said, you know, because he knows about this project that I'm working on,
yeah,
for me to say, I understand that Bob did an interview with so-and-so, you know, is there any way I can get a copy of it, or is there a way that this can be made available?
Yeah. Well, I don't see why it wouldn't work.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think that might be a way to...
Yes.
To see what the problem is.
Yeah. You know? Well, of course, the people you're interested in are not all the ones that I'm interested in.
Exactly. And, no, we touch on a tangent here.
Right. True.
So,
yeah.
And when you send me the list of the people you've done, what I'll do is look it over and I'll probably send you back some suggestions, at least in the contra dance world, of people you might be interested
yes,
in.
Yes, that'll be great. Yep.
Okay. Because there are definitely some key people in contra dancing. And if you're going to be working, doing more in New England, you might want to talk to some of these other folks.
Yes. In fact, I was going to ask you about that.
Okay.
Well, we're almost down to the end of the second side of this tape anyway.
Yeah.
And so let's call this a day.
Well, thank you very much, and let's stay in touch. I've jotted down a bunch of notes here. I've got Al Brozek and Jim Mayo and Paul Trowbridge and Culver Griffin. And,
yes. Okay.
And just stay in touch, Bob.
All right. Well, stay on the line, and I'll call this the end of the tape.
Okay.